This is Shutters Inc. with Bruce Williams and Glyn Lavender.
Hi, and welcome to episode 369 of Shutters Inc. This is Bruce Williams from shuttersincpodcast.com. Joining me on the line via Skype from Melbourne once again from creativephotoworkshops.com.au, Mr. Glyn Lavender. How are you?
Sorry, everyone, I'm back.
Good to have you back, mate.
Yeah, you're just saying that.
That's right.
Say it again. I like to feel welcome.
Good to have you back.
It's good to be back.
So we know how your last couple of weeks have been.
Yeah, pretty shitty.
Yeah.
Technical term.
Sorry.
But,
sorry to hear that.
But you know what? If nothing else, it brought home the importance of photos to me again.
Oh, I can imagine.
Having to hunt through just how few photographs you have of someone from a young age, you know?
Yeah, right.
You know, all the way through. Just trying to put together some sort of coherent timeline of someone's life via photos for a slideshow is a fairly daunting experience, but it's also so hard. There's whole gaps of things. There's just no photos.
Yeah.
There's whole gaps. I mean, I think I had photos of the family with Dad up until quite a good, reasonable quantity up till about, I don't know, maybe we were maybe 8 years old.
Right.
And then from 8 to about 13 or 14, we couldn't find anything.
Right.
You know, like a 5-year gap with just bugger all, you know?
Yeah, wow.
And it's just like, yeah, but, you know, and these are important. So there's going to be photos somewhere, but, you know, the whole thing about protecting and looking after them and everything else. Yeah. But as I always said to Dad over the last couple of years, a few times, we'd had to do some proper portraits.
Yep.
Some real photos. I said, I'm here to do your coffin shots. And turned out, guess what we used?
Yeah.
The coffin shot.
Exactly.
But, you know, so I captured the series of three photos of my Dad.
Yeah.
All in the same light, all properly posed, all properly set up for a portrait shot of him. And one where he's just looking down the camera with a cheeky glint in his eyes and a half smile, which perfectly encapsulated who he was.
Nice.
So, I mean, anyone who saw that photo who knew him went, that's him.
Yeah, right.
And it just blew everyone away because this one photograph encapsulated a person completely.
Yeah. You know?
But at the same time, there was two other shots on either. So that was like the centerpiece. On either side, there was one of him just laughing, looking away from camera, laughing.
Yeah.
Because someone had said something funny. And that was just this beautiful, natural moment of humor.
Yep.
And then there was another one where he was just looking a little bit pensive and looking off to camera as well. So in this one little sequence of three photographs, there's every aspect of a person.
Yeah, right.
You know, the melancholy, the outright joy, and then the cheekiness.
Yeah, you know? Right.
And it was just so that the power of those three images, and especially when I had those done up as 8x12s and behind Dad's coffin.
Yep.
And so everyone who came to the funeral, the first thing they saw was these photos, and there's people just like, oh wow, you know, that is just a few good photographs stood out so much.
Yeah.
You know? And so yeah, I'm very fortunate to be able to do that sort of stuff and do it well. But it just really brings home just how super important we take photos of people who mean something to us are.
Yeah.
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 And so just today, my lovely friend Erin Manning in America, her father died.
Yes, I saw that.
So we both lost our dads within a couple of weeks of each other. And being a photographer again, she's posting these beautiful photos of this guy. They're going to last a life. They're it now. They're the ones that are going to last the rest of our existence looking back, you know.
Yeah.
So go out and take bloody good photos, people.
Yeah, that's right.
Don't be embarrassed. Or don't shoot people. Don't you? You'll wish you did.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I look back now and think, I mean, not that I had any skill at all, but I kind of regret the fact that I didn't get a great portrait of my mum before she passed away.
Yeah, absolutely. You know,
10 years ago. But
you haven't improved your skill in those 10 years, though. You have learned something from that and tried to ramp up your skills these last 10 years.
Thank you, mate.
Yeah, here's another weird thing that happened at the funeral. I've got to tell you, I took this photograph before everyone arrived.
Right.
So we've got this empty church and my dad's coffin. And this, the slideshow, well, there's a picture of my dad, up on the screen with a poem my sister-in-law had written underneath. It was like the thing at the background screen whilst people are coming in sort of stuff.
Yep.
And then in the foreground, this is taken with my phone, is my youngest daughter just cuddled up in a chair reading the order of service. So there's really only three commanding elements in the shot. her, the coffin, and this picture of him, and he's sort of looking the same direction as her.
Right.
So powerful, just so simple and so powerful, you know. That brought home again the art of storytelling in a photo and telling it with as few words as possible, as few elements as possible, makes it more and more powerful. And to the point again that, yeah, take photos with whatever you've got.
Yep.
Because, yeah, if you've got something that can take a photo, it's not my 50mm 1.2, well, bad luck, take the photo.
Yeah.
It might be really important and it might be something you really value, you know?
Yeah.
That's not the snobbiness of photography get in the way of the end result of the image we're trying to take. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I did this slideshow for Dad. It was 7 minutes long and I thought I'd have to enlist your help for some audio stuff for fading and stuff because I was doing my head in, but I've managed to work it all out.
Cool.
And I completed the file. So I made an end product, a full finished movie, basically.
Nice.
Okay, so it was 7.5 minutes long, but everything was finished. The sound was finished. Everything was done. Yeah. And it was like, started off with like 7 seconds of silence, you know?
Okay.
Built into his favorite movie was Shrek.
Right? Okay.
So it gives you an idea what he's like. And Mum really wanted a song from that in his service.
Okay.
So I put the I'm a Believer. Then I saw her face. But I did that around all their wedding photos. So it was kind of nice. Then I faded into another song. It was when the kids came along. Then fade into this beautiful other song from one of his other favorite bands. And then it ended with silence. And just him, that look away laughing photograph of him. And then some words.
Yep.
But come the actual, and I tested this thing like 50 freaking times. It was perfect. Perfect. You know, nothing was going to go wrong. Got it up on the screen. My nephew was operating the computer. Everything, the transitions, the sound, it all looked great. Came to the seven seconds of silence, and somehow the music kicked back in again. So the end of the last song was just quite this big operatic. And it was like, it was perfect. It was like the ending was perfect. And it faded out, that naturally faded out to nothing, to this silence. And then these beautiful words. And the words were, if a man's worth can be told by the weight of tears shed after his death, then he was a very rich man. Right? Something like that.
Okay.
So it was this really poignant moment. And just as that came up, the music went, "Nah!" I don't know how that's possible.
Oh, dear.
And then it cut off. So it should have been up there for like 10 seconds, just held there, and then everything cut off. So it was, rah! Boom, gone. Oh, that's a bit weird. How
weird.
Very strange. Oh. So anyway, day before that happened, I did pick up the new Tamron 90mm macro lens.
Oh, okay.
Because I remember when we were last talking, we were talking about the focus limiters.
Yes.
And this Tamron's got 3 focus limiters.
Oh, nice.
So it's got the really, really narrow end beam for macro. So it's just in that little like 0.3 of a meter to 0.5 of a meter focus zone.
Right.
And then it's got a focus one that goes from, like 2 meters to infinity.
Yep.
And the one that does everything from 0.3 all the way to infinity.
Nice.
So just thought, I haven't had the chance to take a single photograph with it yet.
Right.
Weeks now, taking a single photograph, but I will look forward to. I've got a whole bunch of dying flowers here.
Oh, okay.
I thought maybe I'll take a photo of some dying flowers. I think it's kind of fun about funerals. People bring you these flowers as a lovely gesture, and then they all die slowly in front of you, and you have to throw their carcasses out. It's like death relived 1,000 times.
Dear. Anyway.
So what have we got for tonight? Because I'm down 18% of my battery already.
Right.
And I said earlier, I'm far too lazy to walk in the room to get the AC.
I was walking around the other night in the city. I was on my way to a show, and I saw a guy's T-shirt, and the quote that was on it, I absolutely loved. I remembered it there and then and thought, I've got to include this in Shutter Zinc. On his T-shirt, it said, "If you think it's expensive to hire a professional, just wait till you hire an amateur." And I thought, that is perfect.
Oh, I love it.
So, a story I came across today was about Instagram supposedly, they use the term shadow banning
accounts.
And it seems to only be related to business accounts on Instagram. And what's happening is that photographers are putting up images and they can do a search based on, you know, certain tags that they've attached yeah. to their image, and they can see their image in the search results.
Yeah.
But if they then log in via any other user account and do the same search, their image is not being included in the search results. Now, Instagram's official response is that it's a bug in the system and that they're working on it, but it sounds a little bit...
like, we're not showing unless you're paying.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it sounds like. So, interesting.
Who knows how much of that stuff... We know that with Facebook. Yeah. Business accounts on Facebook. Just how little traction your Facebook pages... It used to have great connection with customers, and now you know, you're getting 1%, 2%. Yeah, hit rates.
Mate, it's the same with the podcast pages, you know?
Yeah.
Both the page for Shutters Inc. and the page for Sign Language. I've noticed that the number of people reached, you know, as the owner of the page, you can see how many people a post reached, has dropped to, you know, double digits, where it used to be, you know, triple digits. So, you know.
Yeah.
And because I don't make any money out of either of the podcasts, I'm not about to go spending money to, you know, boost the reach of a post. So, yeah.
Just looking through your notes you sent through, there's that really big one that I said, let's dedicate a whack of time to this.
Yeah.
So maybe we'll skip some of my stuff today. We'll make some, but this is supposed to be done about 3 months ago.
Okay.
So the question was asked and I never get around to answering it. So.
Okay. Do you want to jump into that now?
Yeah, do you want to read it so I can remember what it
says? Hello, Glenn. I love listening to the podcasts. They are educational, funny, and entertaining. Not sure if this is
strange.
Yeah, not sure if this is the right place to ask a question, but I'd like to master using my speed light flash. It would be great if you could cover this in a future show. I've tried, and sometimes it turns out okay, but generally my efforts are all underexposed, and I have to try and fix in Lightroom. Think I haven't really mastered the starting point and how to meter the scene. I just haven't got my head round what settings I need to use or what I need to change if I'm not getting the result I want. Last night I was trying to do a portrait shot in my house. It was evening time, so I needed to have some lights on in the house or it would have been pitch black. So do I just meter for the background and then introduce my subject and try and light them with a flash, or should I switch all other lights off and just try to use the flash and somehow try and work out how to meter it? I have a Lumix GX7 using a Mikey MK320. Your flash shots always seem to be perfectly exposed. Anyway, keep up the good work. Hope you don't mind me messaging you. Regards, Steve.
This is Stephen Edgar, by the way. Just
right. Now, shall I read the second?
And then go to the second one as well, yeah.
Hi, Glenn. Just listening to the podcast reminded me, I don't think you ever got around to answering my question. I would really, really appreciate if you could do a small bit on flash photography. I really struggle with this area. How do you set the camera up differently when using flash? Normally, if the scene was dark, I would crank up the ISO. But what do I do with ISO if I'm using flash? Manual setup. Also, regarding TTL, if I'm going to bounce the flash, does TTL still work correctly, or does it only work with direct flash? I've seen some of your flash shots and they look great, so any tips you could give would be greatly appreciated. Thanks in advance, Steve from Belfast.
It's got a little bit down there. Also, if I'm taking a portrait in my house at night, should I switch the house lights on or off? Yep. Or do I just rely on the flash? Okay.
Yeah, well, he had that in the first message, yeah.
Okay, I wasn't listening. So here's the thing. Okay, there's so many things here to address. So let's talk about the indoor portraits to start with, okay? Because that's the thing. There is nothing different than doing an indoor portrait with flash than doing a photograph of a building without flash. Okay, so if I'm trying to photograph a room, okay, let's say for the sake of it, a reception at a wedding. Okay, because that we can sort of visualize that space and the kind of dim lighting. And maybe that lighting's got some nice chandeliers and some nice candles on the table. So it's got some nice mood lighting, but it's dark.
Mm-hmm.
Can we visualize that scene pretty well?
Yep.
Okay, so the first and foremost, anytime you're taking a photograph, if you have to forget the fact that you're photographing a person and you've got to forget the fact that you're using flash.
Yep.
Because they're secondary thoughts. Thought number one is, how do I make this scene look any good or look the way I want it to look?
Yep.
So that may be, let's say it's a fairly dark room, maybe I need to use 1600 ISO. Maybe I need to use f4, let's say, because maybe it's not a lens that goes down much more than that. It's pretty wide open. And to be able to see some of those lovely mood lights in the background, maybe I need to be using, let's say, a 15th of a second.
Yep.
Something in that sort of category, give or take. If you just took a photo of the room with those settings,
yep,
you'd be able to see somewhat similar to what you see with your naked eye, let's say. I've got some nice mood lighting from the candles on the tables. I've got some nice light on the roof from the chandeliers and all that sort of stuff. And I can see just some of the basic structure of what's going on in the room. Does that make sense?
Yep.
So you've established that.
And white balance?
Well, white balance is...
It's a matter of taste.
A matter of taste, yeah. Now, I'm a big auto white balance kind of guy. Yeah. Because I'm lazy.
That's because you're lazy.
Yeah. But here's the thing. I mean, the problem with the flash is going to put out a very cold light.
Yes.
If you've got a room with lots of candles and chandeliers that are putting out a warm light, it's going to look a little bit incongruent,
mm-hmm,
a little bit out of whack.
Yep.
So what I would do in that situation on my flash, I would put what's called a quarter CTO gel, a quarter color temperature orange gel. Yep. That would just warm the light coming out of the flash so it's not so pale and white, and kind of balances a little bit more with the background light.
Yep. Now, before you go on,
yes,
I'm just going to jump in and say, Steve,
yeah, I want you to be the adversary.
You don't have to spend a bucket load to buy gels. If you jump on eBay and search, color gels flash photography, you will find that there's really good stuff, like the stuff that Dave Honnell makes, which will cost you a little bit. But there is much cheaper options around, and essentially you're just looking for stuff that is the colour you need in order to match up with whatever light source you're trying to match. Back to Glenn.
And the good stuff about the Honnell stuff, so that's H-O-N-L, is it's really thick. It lasts. You can rip it on and off your flash for years, and they keep on working.
Yep.
The cheap ones will fall apart, you'll keep on buying, like anything in life.
Absolutely.
If you're not sure if you're going to use it much, go and buy some cheap ones. Side if you like it. If you do, you might then invest in some decent ones.
Yep.
And when you are on David's site, that's Honnell, H-O-N-L, photo.com. Whatever you're buying, type in the name Glenn into the discount code area, you get 10% off.
Nice.
So let's assume we're doing on-camera flash shots at this reception.
Yep.
Now, you've got a couple of choices. Is there an ability to bounce, say, sideways off a wall or above off a ceiling? Are those options available to you? Now, what I would normally do in that sort of situation is I would try and find a side wall I could bounce off, and I would, rather than photographing people where they're standing, I would drag them over to where I want to photograph them, where I've got the best control.
Yep.
Okay. But if I don't have those options, I'll use direct flash. Okay. So straight mm-hmm. at their head. Okay.
Yep.
Now, if the flash is on the camera, I always use TTL flash or ETTL if you're a Canon user.
Yep.
So I always let the camera and the flash do the talking when they're connected.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, I don't know how it works. It's magic TV, as my kids would say. But if I bounce it off the ceiling or if I side bounce it, majority of the time, it still does a pretty decent job of getting the right amount of power. So it knows it's bouncing. I don't know how it knows the distances and the angles, etc. But what I'll do a shot, bang. And then if the flash is a little bit under or overpowered, I would then use flash exposure compensation to just edge it up a bit, like a dimmer switch, up or down a little bit.
Yep.
That would be my choice.
Most of the time, if you are bouncing, it will tend to err on the side of being a little underexposed, and you may need some positive. I've never known bounce flash to overexpose.
If you get your ambient light right.
Yep.
Your flash will be a lot more accurate.
Yeah.
Your flash issues come in when you don't get your ambient exposure.
Correct.
Well understood. So let's say the same scenario, the same reception place, and I don't like using under 1/100 of a second because I don't have very steady hands, and I don't like using 1600 ISO because it's too noisy, so I'll use 400 ISO.
Mm-hmm.
If you use those kind of settings, what's going to happen is your ambient light's going to all but disappear.
Yep.
So your background's going to be black behind the subject.
Yep, with just these little orange dots where the candles were.
Possibly, exactly. Whereas, therefore, any flash you put on the subject is going to look harsh because it's got this massive contrast of black behind it. So even that shot that you may have thought was a little bit erred on the side of under before may now look over because it's got nothing else to compare it with.
Yep.
So the biggest problem, and this is maybe what Steve is having, is not establishing the room looking the way you want it to.
The ambient.
Now,
first.
Do I turn the house lights on or off, Steve says. Well, do they look good in the shot?
Hang on. Before you get to that,
we need
to just dial it back 30 seconds.
Sure.
Where you were talking about the photographer who thinks to themselves, no, I can't shoot less than a hundredth of a second.
Yeah.
If you are supplementing your image with flash, you can get away with much slower shutter speeds. Because
how?
Let me tell you, Glenn. Let me explain it to you. Because the burst of light from the flash is measured in thousandths of seconds, and it will freeze what happens. Even if you're shooting a handheld at a quarter of a second, you are effectively getting this like thousandth of a second burst of light, which will freeze everything.
Using a tripod, I've frozen subjects that have been moving for 10 seconds in a frame.
Right.
And then the flash at the end of the exposure freezes the subject. So even though they've been moving, so people twirling flames as if fire as an example, they're spinning the fire for 8 or 9 or 10 seconds, and then flash at the end will freeze them.
Yeah.
So the flash does a pretty darn good job of freezing your moving subject and also any movement you may have.
Yeah.
The problem is the ambient light in the background
will blur.
May blur if you move an awful lot. It can look really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. It can look
really good. If it looks really, if you don't like that look and you're doing a pretty crappy job of hand holding it at a fifteenth of a second, a little monopod.
Yep.
It'll just give that little bit of stability just for that little period of time. It doesn't need much just to make it that little bit more stable and away you go. So that comes to pretty much every perception.
Before we move on. Sorry. Just on that point of tripods, monopods, etc. Do a Google search for Joe McNally's stance where he pushes the camera up against his shoulder.
Oh, yeah. The McNally hold.
It's just the what hold?
The McNally hold.
Oh, okay. Yeah, right. Steve, just check that out, because it's a great way of just getting a little more stability when you don't have a monopod or a tripod at your disposal.
Everybody check that out.
Yes, definitely.
It's pretty cool. So every reception place I've ever shot, my ISO has always been 1600 or 3200. My shutter speed's always been in the 15th of a second. And my aperture's always been around about F4.
Wow.
That covers pretty much every darn dark reception place you're ever going to go into. And it's going to get the background looking pretty darn sweet and nice. And if you are in an expensive reception place, they've spent a lot of money to be there. They want to see it in the photos.
Yeah.
So that will get your background right. And the other advantage is then the flash doesn't have to work very hard. It just winks out light. Gentle little bit of wink, and therefore your flash recycle time is really quick.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's one scenario. Scenario number two, let's talk about Steve's inside his house. Well, once again, if I try to incorporate that lighting that's in the house into the shot, then maybe I need to use a higher ISO and a slow shutter speed, similar scenario. But let's say I'm photographing in a normal lounge room, and I want to eliminate that light because that light just is horrible. I don't want to turn off that light, because if I turn off the light, the camera's going to have trouble focusing, my subjects can't see me, I probably can't see them. So if you leave those lights on, but now we go the other way. Now maybe we drop our ISO way back down to like 100.
Mm-hmm.
And when we're using flash, we have a maximum shutter speed we can use with flash, which is usually around about 200th of a second.
Yep.
A sinking speed. So I'm going to increase my shutter speed to around about 200th.
Yep.
And then I'm going to use whatever aperture is necessary, more than likely around about F8, F11, to knock out all the ambient light. So now if I take a photograph without the flash on the camera, the photo will come out completely black.
Yep.
If it comes out completely black, I can leave all the lights in the room on because, well, then we can talk, we can see each other. This is what we do in studio photography.
Yeah.
We have all the lights on in the studio, so we can see each other. But when we take the photograph, the settings of the camera eliminate all that ambient light. And the only light that shows up in the shot is the flash light that we put in.
Yep.
So once again, if I'm trying to eliminate the light in the room, I want to go those kind of numbers. If I'm going to try and include the light in the room, I've got to treat it like a normal shot of a room. And how do I make the room look good first?
Yep.
So we talked about on camera flash before. Look, even if I'm doing that indoor room stuff, if I come side bounce off a wall or something and get the shot looking the way I want, I'm going to use an on camera flash. Because it's simple, it's quick. I don't want to have to be setting up stands, etc., all that other stuff, because it's a bit of a pain. Okay.
Yeah.
That's option A. But if I want to do some off-camera flash, and I don't want to invest in all the money in all this TTL stuff. If you're doing off-camera flash with TTL, the camera and the flash would talk to each other. The flash would put out the power it thinks is necessary. You may need to override that with the flash exposure compensation to brighten and darken it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, these days, it's getting pretty cheap to do TTL off-camera flash, so it doesn't necessarily have to be an awful lot of money, but it's not as consistent when it's not on the camera because it's pointing at different angles and so on. So it can do your hair a little bit. So what I like to do is I like to do manual flash.
Yep.
And the manual flash system I've always used is find out what the power of the flash is. Now, I don't know this flash that Steve uses. It's got the number 320 or something in there. I'm going to say it's probably about a guide number.
Number of 32?
I doubt it. Yeah, there's not many low ones these days. It could be. It might be a tiny flash.
Yeah.
I don't know. But if you can look in the instruction manual somewhere, you'll find a thing called the guide number. And the guide number is like the engine power of a car engine, V8, V6, V4. It's this potential power output kind of thing. And so what that number is that guide number, let's say that guide number, let's say for the sake of it, is 32, same as the model number. That's its power in meters at 100 ISO. That flash can go about 32 meters at 100 ISO.
Now, that's based on an aperture of F1, right?
At zero aperture, you pretty much effectively, without taking a lens into account at all.
And before we move on from that, am I right in thinking that in America they refer to it in feet, but we refer to it in meters?
In America, it's feet. So what I like to do when I'm training in the US, I call them big steps.
Right.
So it's 32 big steps. And when I train...
The
shorter folk, it's really big steps. Because, it doesn't have to be overly accurate. A big step's going to be around about a meter.
Yeah.
You know? So here's the way flash works. It's power, guide number 32, divided by the aperture you want to use. Let's say I was using F11 to knock out all that ambient light. Well, 32 divided by 11 is a bit hard. So I'd round that 32 up to 33.
Yep.
33 divided by 11 is, Bruce?
Three.
Three. Oh, I thought we'd lost you.
No.
Did you use a calculator?
No.
So that 3 meters away at full power is correct exposure.
Yeah.
It's perfect exposure.
But that's at 100 ISO.
At 100 ISO.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's 33 divided by 11 is 3. 3 big steps away at full power, 1.5 steps away at half power, 3/4 of a big step away at quarter power if you want to power the flash down. And you'd power the flash down because it would recycle faster and give you more shots quicker.
Yep. And the thing to bear in mind with the ISO is that it doesn't double for each one stop. It doubles for every two stops.
Huh?
Okay. So if you get 3 meters at 100 ISO, you'll need to go to 400 ISO before you get 6 meters of coverage.
No. Full twang.
Okay.
It's exactly double, dude.
Okay.
So 100 ISO. So what happens is, for every ISO that you, so I'm not talking about going from 100 to 125 to 160. Every time you double the number, you double the distance.
Okay.
So 100 to 200, you go from 3 to 6. You go from 200 to 400, you go from 6 to 12. You go from 400 to 800, you go from 12 to 24, and so on and so forth.
Okay.
And then you can do the half power, the quarter power, the eighth power, move the flash. Look, I know it's complex. It's not an easy thing just to talk and grasp. But if you can understand that the flash has got a certain power. Aperture controls the volume of light your camera lets in. So aperture controls the flash brightness. So even if you're struggling to try and figure out how to work it, if you just turn your aperture dial like a dimmer switch, that will fix your exposure brightness on your flash. One way I'll make it brighter, the other way I'll make it darker.
Yep.
So if you just want to intuitively feel it rather than trying, if you're not really hankered on, I've got to be using F8 for this photograph. If you don't, like in studio photography, if you're not that hung up on aperture, it can be 8, 11, 13, doesn't really matter. If you're adjusting your aperture just as a dimmer switch, you'll find the sweet spot pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So if you remember, every time your flash is too bright or too dark, aperture's the thing that's going to fix it.
Yeah.
If you get to the point where, okay, I've tapped my aperture and it's still wrong, well, then you can start using ISO. Oh, it's still a bit too dark. Well, if you bump your ISO up, all light gets more sensitive, so it's going to start to incorporate. The last scenario is if you're outdoors taking photos.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you're outdoors taking photographs, effectively it's a landscape photograph, and then you add flash at the end. So it's a bit like shooting the reception place. You've got to establish the scene to look the way you want first and foremost.
Yep.
Now, the big limiter when it comes to using flash is that shutter speed, maximum shutter speed you can use to sync the flash.
Yeah.
So if you're going outdoors on a bright day, well, you're going to drop your ISO as low as you can. Yeah. The next thing you can do is going to go to your maximum shutter speed that you can know you can use with flash, so say 200. Then you're going to figure out what aperture do I need to get the scene looking the way I want. And almost always, I want the scene to be underexposed. I want the scene to be darker
yep.
than I see with my eye, because then the flash will stand out more.
Yep.
So I'm normally one stop or two stops and sometimes three stops underexposing that scene. So if you can go outside and shoot in manual and create a landscape correctly exposed, well, you can do flash because it's the same thing. So let's say you're outdoors, you've got your ISO down up to 100 and your aperture, let's say, is up to 22 because you know you really want to knock out the ambient light as much as possible. And you've got that 32 guide number flash. Well, it's 22 divided by 32, which is, once again, a bit hard.
Other way around, so 32 divided by 22.
That's what yep. I said.
Yep.
I was speaking for the less Dixic among us. So it's 32 divided by 22, which is too hard. So 30 divided by 20, a little bit easier,
yep.
1.5. So it's 1.5 big steps away from your subject of full power will give you correct brightness.
Yep.
So that's kind of the flow of it. I know it's hard to succinct into a couple of minutes. But if you can just grasp the concepts of that, there's a mathematical formula that once you grasp it, every photo will be correctly exposed first shot every shot, which makes life very easy.
Yep.
If you can't grasp it, just use your aperture as a dimmer switch.
Mm-hmm.
Remembering your aperture is going to affect all light in the scene, so it's going to affect the ambient light as well. But if you're stuck and pulling your hair out, and you can't get your flash brightness right. Well, the other thing is you can move the flash further away or closer.
Yeah? Yep.
That's always an option. But it can be fairly intuitive. I don't have an awful lot of settings I use when I use flash, especially outdoors, because I'm always trying to knock down the ambient. It's usually pretty bright. So I'm often up at F22.
Yeah.
My flash has a guide number of 44. So it's always 44 divided by 22. So it's always 2 meters away at full power, 1 meter away at half power.
Yep.
So pretty much I could walk around for an entire afternoon shooting on a bright summer's day, not change a single setting on my camera, not change a single setting on my flash, just keep putting down the same distance away for every shoot we do.
Yeah.
And you go bang, 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 really simple.
The one thing I will add, Steve, if you want to do those sorts of outdoor shots like Glyn does with a model and you do have a flash that doesn't have a whole lot of grunt, yeah. Your best friend would be a 3-stop or a 6-stop neutral density filter, because that will allow you to set your shutter speed to a 250th, and it will allow you to get your aperture a little bit wider, because the neutral density filter is going to, soak up some of that exposure for you, so that your, slightly less powerful flash can still do the job of, the big-ass flash that Glyn normally uses.
But you know what? $60, $80 will go buy you a powerful flash these days.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so if you want to do this sort of stuff and you're not worried about, you buy an El Cheapo one off the internet to not use on your camera, you want to do off-camera flash, buy a cheap trigger, a cheap off-camera flash, and for $100, $150, you're away shooting with a much more powerful unit and you won't have all those problems. It's probably cost you half as much twice as much again as what the filter will cost you. Because a good filter is going to set you back a few bucks anyway.
Yep.
And you've got a much more versatile tool for all sorts of environments. So. Yeah.
And it's interesting that you should mention the cheaper, product that's out there these days. Because one of the stories that I had this week, which I think Adam submitted, was about Cactus releasing new firmware, which will allow you to do TTL off-camera flash with their Cactus triggers, mixing and matching brands of flash and cameras, and doing high speed sync.
Yeah, I've heard about that a few weeks ago.
Yeah, right.
From the new importers of Cactus into Australia were telling me about it. I was like, oh, that's interesting.
Have you had any hands on?
So, I'm a Godox user. I use the Godox stuff.
Right.
I'm sponsored by them somewhat.
Yep.
And Cactus wanted me to take on some stuff. And I don't know.
Yeah.
But I do like that idea. Because I've got half a dozen Canon flashes laying around as well that don't get used. Just gather dust.
Right.
Mind you, I've got 40 flashes. There's a lot of them gathering dust. But the ability to mix and match between say a Cactus and a Canon and a Nikon and whatever else is laying around is pretty good. So.
Absolutely.
So I hope that helps a little bit, Steve. I mean, look, message me back if any of anything you want clarifying, or if you're not quite grabbing it, and I'll try and put it down in word form. Yeah, I'll try and answer those questions as well for you. But
in about 12 months' time. Yep.
No.
Six. Six, okay. Oh, dear.
Oh, we're down to 54%. We've got to be moving.
Right. Dave King, who listens to both my podcasts, sent us a message this week and said, hey, I have a new all-in-one PC with a large, beautiful display, as mentioned in the other podcast. I'm using it for processing photos with Lightroom. I have a feeling that the monitor needs to be calibrated because I'm noticing some inconsistencies when viewing my images on other devices. Do you have any recommendations on an inexpensive yet effective way to calibrate PC monitors? So it's obviously not a Mac. Curiously, this monitor has no adjustment controls on the monitor itself. The only changes that can be made are in the accompanying Windows 10 software. Thanks. Well, that's rather interesting. Normally they have soft buttons, even if it's just an on-screen menu, you can normally tweak contrast and brightness and color space and whatnot, but if it doesn't, it doesn't. But anyway, thoughts on calibration?
Control through Windows. Spider.
Yeah.
Go for spiders. Spiders are awesome.
Now, what are they worth? They're about $300, aren't they?
I don't know. I don't pay for things.
Which is kind of the price you'd pay for a good monitor or a half-decent monitor. Darren Purbrick is turning over in his grave at me saying it was a decent monitor.
Yeah, but if you buy a half-decent monitor, then you've got to buy the colour calibrator to make it half-decent. So it doesn't – it's hard to say that, but then you're still going to buy the spider on top of the half-decent monitor. I honestly don't know because it's not something I ever use. I don't really care too much about colour. I know.
Auto white balance will fix everything.
There's a free piece of software which will fix everything in that situation. It's called Silver FX Pro from Nick. It turns everything black and white.
Yeah, that's right. So
if you really stuff up your colours, just turn it black and white. Yeah. The spiders are very good. I don't think there's any really foolproof, cheap way to do it. But there's one other way you could go about it.
Right.
If we're talking about printing versus viewing, because look, viewing, there could be vagaries from the brightness of the screen. There's so many variations of why it could be doing it. What program's showing it on. So if I show a photo on my iPhone, it looks very different than I show it on my Surface, as an example, you know.
Right.
But if you're talking about the printing side of things, if you go to a really good lab, like a pro lab, mum and dad,
Not Big W's Photo Lab.
Yeah, they will help you. They will give you some guidance about how they print. Okay, yeah. They'll say, look, here's a color chart on a file, and here's a color chart printed out. Yeah, what you want to do is get this color chart on your monitor and adjust the colors until it looks a bit like, or as close as you can, to the printout we give you.
Yep.
And that will show what you're seeing on the screen is going to come out pretty close to exactly what we're printing.
Yep.
So, yeah, have a chat with a decent lab and they might be able to guide you in that way, and that wouldn't cost you anything.
Yep.
Because then, of course, you're limited to using that lab, but you're tuned in then to getting the colour right for printing as best as possible. So I hope that helps a little bit.
Hmm. Okay. Last week, David Marland and I were talking about on-the-go card reader hubs that could act as a one-stop spot for when we're traveling with an Android tablet, that you could plug in both your card reader for your camera's memory card as well as an external hard drive and not have to copy to the tablet in, you know, one step and then copy from the tablet to the hard drive in a second step. So David Marland, I wanted to mention that I jumped on eBay and I bought an on-the-go USB hub and card reader. That's the sound of the packaging. It arrived today. I played with it for about half an hour just before we started recording the podcast, and I had very hit and miss results with it. Sometimes it would read my card reader and other times it wouldn't, so I clearly need to spend a little bit more time with it. Admittedly, I only spent $15 on it, so it may very well be a case of you get what you pay for. We did hear from Frank through the week, and he said, "Re your backup solution, check this item, see if it'll fit your situation. I own one myself. It works very well. It's small and all for travel. It's a Kingston 5-in-1 mobile companion. Thanks, keep up the great work. He's given us a link to Amazon.com, which I went and checked out.
That's two compliments about the podcast in one episode.
I know.
That's two people said nice stuff. So, you get testimonials.
So there'll be a couple of Amazon links there, because when you go to that first link, Amazon will tell you that there's actually an upgraded version of the same product with a link to that. So I'll put both of those in the show notes for anyone that wants to check them out. Reg Vardy posted on the Shutters Inc. Facebook wall this week and said, enjoyed the show this week. It was because Glyn wasn't there, that's why. Face the same backup issues as you gentlemen on a trip to Ireland and Scotland. Purchased a J-Car on-the-go hub and card reader dock for $25. Supplied my own 5-volt power pack. Backed up 1,500-plus images to an SSD drive and USB sticks from a CF card reader using copy and paste on the Samsung tablet. The Lava solution, which is the product that David Marland was referring to last week, is far more elegant and takes up less room. So, yeah. Thank you for all the feedback.
Lots of good solutions out there.
Yeah,
I've just got
in
touch this week with the Narbox, who we talked about a year ago.
Oh, okay.
Which are a little sort of transfer and solution as well, but haven't heard back from them. So there might be another solution down the track.
Okay.
That's worthwhile looking at.
So remind me what it was that they made.
Well, they've got basically it's a portable computer. This is where it kind of differs. The actual unit itself has its own processing engine inside it. So right. Its ability to transfer stuff is significantly faster.
Right.
Than relying on whatever device you're pulling off, transferring to whatever device that's reading it.
Right.
So it's basically a waterproof, shockproof shell with a built-in computer and 128 gig of memory and like 4 gig of RAM or something like that. And it's a similar sort of thing. You plug your card. It's got card reading slots or USB slot. Attach your hard drive to one end and your whatever reader on the other end, and it just transfers stuff through, but also can broadcast. It's also its own app, so you can do your editing on your phone those photos and put them straight up on social media. So it's a computerless solution for transferring video and photo, but it handles up to 4K video footage really well. So that, I'm sure if you're doing that high-end stuff, that internal processor is going to help
in
moving that mass volume of stuff around. So, G-N-A-R box.
Okay.
NAR box. So.
All right. And we got a few things submitted by Adam this week.
Yeah.
First one was, a photographer creates realistic locations for miniature photography on a budget. The first video in this link is a short 2-minute piece, all shot in... Well, shot in real time, but the video has been rendered at 20 times real time playback. So it absolutely cranks through. So it was kind of a little bit hard to work out exactly what sort of products he was using. But man, the amount of time and effort this guy went to create this lunar landscape.
And then he could have photoshopped 11 daylights out of it anyway, so it's kind of doesn't look that real anyway.
I know. I kind of felt a little bit disappointed at the end, because I thought, well, all of the work that he did on the ground was just the lower third of the image, and all the rest of it was Photoshop. But he does, when you look at some of the other projects that he's done, he's put a hell of a lot of work into creating these little miniature landscapes, so good on him.
As they say, just because you can doesn't mean you should.
Yes. Anyway, Adam put me onto a really great YouTube channel last week, which I've watched a couple more videos from, Adam. So thanks, mate. I really am appreciating, what is it? The Art of Photography, I think it was the name of that channel. And he sent us another one.
School of Visual Arts.
Oh, no, I'm referring to the one he told us about last week. So this week he sent us another link to the School of Visual Arts YouTube channel, which is full of amazing photo lectures. Now, on the link that will be in the show notes, there are 3 lectures provided. 2 of them were quite happy to play, but one of them I got a copyright not released in your country, blah, blah, blah. Got the grey screen of fuzz, so... But these are like hour and a half long lectures.
That's a fair commitment, isn't it?
That is a massive commitment. So for anyone who is, bedridden and needs to kill some time,
There's one here from Joe McNally. Goes an hour and 20. But the wonder of light. I mean, you pay big money to go see Joe speak. So, I mean, to get
tell
online,
me about it.
Oh, you did, didn't you, sucker?
I paid $1,000 for that day.
Sounds like it was worth it. Because it was good to see how much your photos improved after that.
You're a mongrel, you know that.
I'm consistent.
The next one was, I was paid to be a camera tester, and I think they actually listened. This was written by Corey Haig, who works for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation.
Corey Haig, must be the guy with I wear my sunglasses Haig. At night. Haig. I wear my sunglasses at night. I bet he gets that all the time.
He probably does. So anyway, this was interesting. He saw this ad pop up in his social media feed saying, you know, photographers wanted for equipment testing by a major manufacturer and promise of payment for being involved in said experiment. And he thought it was all a bit of a scam, but he signed up. And next thing he knew, they actually approached him and said, yes, you qualify, and provided him with gear. And he got to test some equipment that, you know, he hasn't revealed who the manufacturer was, but yeah, he got paid for being involved and for passing on his thoughts on this, you know, about to be released camera. And he says in the text, you know, he was quite surprised that, you know, here he was not a professional photographer, but just a, you know, an enthusiast amateur photographer. Yeah. And the manufacturer was quite happy to listen to his concerns about, you know, the way certain aspects of the camera behaved, you know, despite the...
It'd be interesting to see just how much of it was the manufacturer versus local agents versus, yeah, I mean...
Well, he says manufacturer, so I assume...
Yeah, I know, but, yeah, you know. If Canon Australia came to you, would you assume they're the manufacturer?
No. Good point.
Well, they are Canon. They're owned by Canon. It is, but they're not the researchers. They're not the guy who are going to make it going to make any difference in the product. They're the sales. They're the sales and service divisions.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the PR and marketing are very different from the guys who actually have the. Not saying it's not, but I would take it with a grain of salt.
Yeah.
Somewhat. And if I'd known, I would have told him to mention about the 30 seconds. Yeah. You know, can we have more, please? Please give us more.
Dear.
Lucky him. Yeah. Paid for playing with the camera.
Yeah.
Oh, I do. That's right.
So what do you got on your list?
I'll just shoot through all that stuff on that one. Oh, so for anyone in Australia who has a bit of a liking for the outdoors and you know, night photography and stuff, ABC next week have a three-part show called Stargazing Live.
Right.
It's about stargazing, and it's live, funnily enough. But no, they've got Brian Green, the really famous...
Cox.
Brian Cox, so this is, yeah, Cox, Green Cox, whatever. sounds like mold. Brian Cox, the famous scientist.
Scientist, yep.
And Julia Zemira. They're going to be doing live broadcasting from Siding Spring Observatory, doing live astronomy and discussing the universe and who knows what it could lead to. But it's going to be, I imagine it's going to have some cool stuff on the sky. You might learn some stuff about how to photograph it better.
Yeah.
But if not... It's kind of cool anyway, because I'm a nerd and I love the sky.
So if I'm not mistaken, Siding Spring Observatory is out at Coonabarabran, isn't it? Yes, it is. That's where we went, myself and Malcolm and David Cambry.
That's right.
A couple of years ago, yeah.
That's right, I remember the one, yeah. So that's a radio telescope then, isn't it? Not an optical observatory.
I believe it is a radio telescope, okay, yes.
That'd be interesting. So you won't be learning much about how to take photos then. but I came across this couple of sites that aren't up and running yet but will be soon. You can sign up to be beta testers and if you qualify. One's cape.com.
Right.
Which is you can fly real drones in remote locations around the world from over the internet. So I can be sitting in my bedroom flying a drone in the Sierra deserts.
What?
So there's these drones that are set up around the world in these, so it's the world's first online drone flight platform. You can fly one of our Cape drones through your computer or phone, a real drone in a real place in real time.
Wow.
So if you want to experiment with like flying a drone, well, that could be kind of cool.
You can crash a drone in an exotic location.
Well, apparently all the things like the landing and takeoff's all automated.
Oh, okay. You
just do the flying bit. It's got restrictions about heights and all this sort of stuff where so it doesn't go into outside the law and stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's kind of cool. And the other one I came across is something called wesaturate.com.
Right.
And which is a pretty stupid name, but basically I don't realize that, but you get free RAW and JPEG images put in your email, send access to these emails, to these photos. If you don't have time to go out and take photographs, or you don't have a good bank of images that you're happy working on, you can access their range of free JPEG and RAW files to learn how to process them.
Oh, okay.
So it's kind of it's going to be a learning portal about post-process. I'm sure there'll be some sort of community, and there'll probably be challenges where everyone gets the same photograph and everyone kind of edits it and talks about how they edited it. And it could be something worth watching.
Right.
You know? So I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, right. Nice.
I saw this new lens on Kickstarter.
And
they're promoting their bubble bokeh. And I'm just I'm down to 24%.
We might just scrape home. Hello? You spoke too soon. He did. Good on him. All right. Well, yeah. So the Trio Plan 35 plus f2.8, our first wide angle fine art lens. He's just sent me a text and went, "Dolp." Oh dear, spoke too soon. We'll see if he rings back. So anyway, this wide-angle bubble bokeh lens, they were aiming for $50,000 to get it up and running. They have so far been pledged $540,530, and they've still got 2 weeks to go. I have no idea why Glyn was excited about it. I guess, it does do some nice bubble bokeh. Yeah. Okay. Check out the link. Link will be in the show notes for those that want to have a look at that. What's his next one? YKR DPR DPReview.com samples, Tamron SP 70-200 f2.8 sample gallery. Good night. And he sent me a text. Good night and thank your mother for the rabbits. One other thing I had was the crappy DP review image tests for the new Tamron 70-200. Oh dear. So I shall put that link in the show notes for anyone that wants to check out the awful sample gallery for the new Tamron lens. All right. Sorry for the random tail end to the podcast, but I had a feeling that was going to happen. I did say to him before we started, can you not plug into an AC power adapter? And he goes, oh, no, it's in the other room. I couldn't bother getting it. Oh, good on you. So anyway, I guess we shall finish off with David Marlin's book review. What have you got for us this week, David?
Thanks, Bruce. This time I'm looking at The Photographer's Eye by John Sikowski. It's not to be confused with a very similarly titled book, The Photographer's Eye, Composition and Design for Digital Photographers by Michael Freeman. John Sikowski's book is regarded as a 20th century classic. John was the director of New York's Museum of Modern Art from 1962 to 1991. He was actually picked by Edward Steichen to be Steichen's successor. The Photographer's Eye was an exhibition he curated in 1964, and the book of the exhibition was published in 1966. It was reprinted in 2007 and has remained in print since then. This book has been described as an investigation into what photographs look like and why they look that way. It looks at the point that the invention of photography brought a radically new way to make pictures. While painting is based on synthesis, photographs are based on selection. John's own thesis of this book is that to study photographs, you have to consider both the fine art and the functional tradition as intertwined to make a good photograph. It's pretty heavy stuff. The book's divided into sections that are titled The Thing Itself, The Detail, The Frame, Time, and The Vantage Point. Each section has about a 100-word introduction of the concept. Then there's page after page of photographs to illustrate that theme, and they presumably were from the exhibition. The photos themselves are from both well-known and lesser-known photographers. They are well-selected and arranged and uniformly excellent. They range from early daguerreotypes right through to photographs of the early 1960s. They are not presented chronologically, and that adds to the interest. Now, while being a museum director and photographer himself, John Sarkowski was also elegant with the pen. And here's a couple of examples. In the introduction to the thing itself, one paragraph reads, "Our faith in the truth of a photograph rests on our belief that the lens is impartial and will draw the subject as it is, neither nobler or meaner. This faith may be naive and illusory, for although the lens draws the subject, the photographer defines it. But it persists. The photographer's vision convinces us to the degree that the photographer hides his hand." The introduction to the frame includes the observation, "While the draftsman starts in the middle of the sheet, the photographer starts with the frame." And the introduction to the vantage point has the following: "If the photographer could not move his subject, he could move his camera. To see the subject clearly, often to see it at all, he had to abandon a normal vantage point and shoot his picture from above or below, or from too close or too far away, or from the backside, inverting the order of things, or with the nominal subject of his particular picture half hidden." The statement is well echoed in the selection of photos that follow. And for me, the epitome of the photographs on vantage point is a photograph of the photographer Walter Miller shooting from the Woolworth Building in somewhere in 1912-1913. Now, the Woolworth Building was built between 1910 and 1913, and at the time was the tallest building in the world, and was so from 1913 until 1930. And it's still one of the 100 tallest buildings in the United States. It's just under 800 feet high, and the photographer is sitting near the top, not on the girders of construction, but sitting on a plank protruding no more than 60 centimetres, or 2 feet in the old language, from the open construction girders. No ropes, no harness, no safety gear, no net, just a camera. He's dressed in a tie and waistcoat, would you believe? Now that is very seriously aiming for a different vantage point. All the other buildings around, even multi-story ones, are dwarfed from this photo. Book O has The Photographer's Eye by John Sarkowski, published by the New York Museum of Modern Art, ranging from $30.60 to $1,376. No wonder I stumbled. Yes, and that's right, from $30.60 to $1,376 for the same book. I looked up the New York Museum of Modern Art and looked in their bookstore and in the photography section, and I found it for $29.95 US, plus postage, of course. But I also found a whole lot of other really interesting photography books there. I think... cheers.
Have fun, mate. Have fun. All right, that will do it for another week. Until we speak with you again, take care.
ShutterZincPodcast.com.
Another audio-to-you.com quality podcast.
For questions, comments and feedback, email theboys@ShutterZincPodcast.com.